Hello!
Hey guys, it's Arden Cho.
Hey, I'm Holland Roden.
Hello, this is Ian Bowen.
Hey you guys, this is Melissa Ponzio.
Hi, I'm Lyndon Ashby.
Hi, I'm Dylan Sprayberry.
This is Megan Tandy.
This is Tyler Posey, and you are listening to Not Another.
Not Another.
Not Another.
This is Not Another Teen Wolf Podcast.
Yes, it is!
Oh.
Woo!
Hey, this is Jeff Davis. You're listening to Not Another Teen Wolf Podcast, my favorite podcast in the world.
'Cause your heart is pure gold. You see in me what I keep covered in clothes. You never push it, but I know that you do. My head down, eyes low. How could I leave? I would be broken in two. You give me freedom that leads me to you.
Hi everyone, welcome back to Not Another Teen Wolf podcast, your second episode from us this week, talking about the episode of Teen Wolf that just aired, Codominance. As promised in the last episode, we are online today with Will Wallace, who is the writer of this episode, and so we're doing a little bit of an interview about, you know, what went down in the episode and some of the procedures, and you know, see what we can drag out of him about what it all means and how that's gonna go. So Karen and I are here to talk to Will today. Will's been on the podcast before, so hello everyone.
Hey.
Hi.
Hi. Hi.
I am happy to be back.
Gang's all here. Cool. So as usual, if you want to reach us, you can join us on our Twitter, which is NATWpodcast, email on natwpodcast@gmail.com. You can follow our Tumblr at notanotherteenwolfpodcast.tumblr.com, or our Instagram is natwpodcast.com as well. So, yeah, as I mentioned, we are joined today by a special guest, Will Wallace, and we're going to interview him about the episode that just aired. Codominance, which was his episode with his name on it, though we have spoken to quite a few of the writers on the show about the writing process and how that actually works with individual writers doing individual episodes. So we'll probably talk a little bit more about that now. So Karen, do you wanna kick things off here?
Yeah, because I mean, you haven't listened to the episode yet, but we gave it high praise just in case you were worried. Because
oh, thank God.
Yeah, I know that, you know, that's really important to you that we accept this episode.
Yeah,
very.
No, I'm just being funny. But no, it was an excellent episode and we had a lot of really great things to say about it. And it was exciting to see Kira back, of course.
Oh, yeah.
But to kind of kick off, you know, last time we talked to you, you weren't a staff writer for Teen Wolf. That has changed and that feels like kind of a big deal. So how did that come about and what does that actually mean?
Well, it is a big deal. It's quite wonderful. It's what I've been working towards for the last 9 years while living in Los Angeles. And it came about just I became the writer's assistant in season 3. And I guess I just did, you know, a good enough job with generating ideas at the table with Jeff and the other writers that eventually at some point at the end of season 4 and the end of season or at the end of season 4 and the beginning of season 5, Jeff was just like, Will, you're not doing any assistant stuff anymore. You're not going to get lunch. You're not going on coffee runs. You're not doing any of that. We can't lose you from the room anymore, which made me, of course, feel very giddy and happy inside.
Oh.
And then at the end of season 5, we were kind of wrapping up the last couple episodes, and Jeff was just like, all right, Will, it's time, you know, next for season 6, you're a staff writer and you're not going to be the assistant anymore. And that was really that. And I want to say there was a little bit more pomp and circumstance to it, but honestly, for all of season 5 and the majority of season 4, I was doing the job of a staff writer. You know, I was doing all of the assistant work, but I was sitting at the table with everyone and contributing as much as I could. And that's really thanks to Jeff, just because Jeff is very much of the opinion, if you're sitting at the table with the writers, you have to carry your own weight. You know, you can't just sit there and not do anything. And so I spoke up and helped generate ideas. And then it just became official. So now I'm now the newest staff writer on the show.
Congratulations.
Yay. Thank you very much. It's very exciting. I'm quite happy.
Yeah, I can't imagine what it feels like to be that driven. I'm not that driven about anything. probably why I'm not successful at anything. But no, it is. It's really cool. Like, you know, that it is an atmosphere in which persistence, you know, can be paid off, and the value of what you're doing is, you know, recognized and not undermined and stuff like that. So it is really cool that they decided to do that and that you wanted to do that as well, I suppose. So that's good. Good times.
Yeah, I'm very happy because I don't have any other skills. Mm. So it's either I'm a television writer or I work at McDonald's. Mm. I really have nothing to fall back on. So I was really happy when Jeff was like, all right, you're a writer now. And I was like, okay. Oh, thank God. My parents can be proud of me now.
You know what? That is so awesome, though, because I read an interview with Jeff like sometime last year, and mm-hmm. he said, and I actually have this written on my wall. He said, there is no plan B.
No plan B. Yeah.
And
yeah,
it's
no,
like my favorite
absolutely.
Quote.
Yeah.
And no, I think that's just a great way to tackle life.
Yeah. And nearly every. Oh, sorry, Will, go on.
No. I was just saying it is. Yes, it's a great way to plan life.
Yeah, and I was having a conversation with someone about this recently as well about, you know, and it's someone I have worked with who knows a lot of very successful people, like knows some of his friends have become world famous, basically. Mm-hmm. And he was talking about the fact that everyone that he knows that has had that success, it's kind of like, you know, they've got in whatever field it is, they've gotten to the point where it's like, oh, you know, it is where they have no fallback. It's kind of like, no, it's just this, only this. I'm going to do this and I'm going to succeed at it, or I'm going to flop, basically, if you know what I mean. Like,
right.
They don't have backup plans or other options, like that they're, you know, they don't, like, basically they don't give themselves the opportunity to half-ass it by having another, oh, you know, but I could just go and be like a social worker, or, you know, they don't have a backup. Not that being a social worker is an easy job by any stretch of the imagination.
Oh,
but
God,
they don't,
no.
You know, but they don't have, like, another vocation that they're, like, kind of falling back on. They don't have, you know, oh, I kind of, or even, like, different art forms. Oh, I kind of like painting, but I kind of like writing music, and I kind of like writing books. And then it's like, oh, I could dabble. And it's, like, only when people stop dabbling and they're like, no, this is what I'm going to do. And there's not going to be a plan B. Every bit of energy I can afford to put into it is going to be this. And it's only people with that attitude that really get successful. So, yeah. Anyway.
Yeah, it's...
This has got introspective yeah, I mean, and I've, weird.
No, not at all. I mean, I wanted to be a television writer or just a writer in general since the eighth grade. And it was really that or nothing for me. And when I was in college... I went to film school and I thought I was going to be a producer / editor. And I did a ton of that in college and I had a great time with it, but just nothing ever made me as happy as writing, you know, and then it was just after college when I had a couple of months between college and moving to Los Angeles that I just dove into writing, you know, one really bad movie. And I just loved it so much. I just realized that, you know, there is nothing else for me. If I don't make it as a writer, then I'll go to school to be a plumber or something and I'll do the job. You know, I mean, I got to make a living somehow, but nothing will ever make me as happy as getting to sit at a table with a group of great people and just talk story and character and figure out where we're going to take all these characters that we love. And yeah, so. So, yeah, that's all
cool.
I got.
That's cool and fun and deep and stuff. So, you know, speaking of that kind of collaborative process with the table, you know, we've spoken to you before. We've spoken to, you know, Angela and we've spoken to Jeff about how the writing process works, that it's not exactly like one person works in a vacuum, you know, with an episode. It's kind of like you all make up the story together and then sort of one person is responsible for putting it down on paper, you know.
Right.
So, you know, with this particular episode, Codominance, what part of it kind of was your idea the most, if you know what I mean? Where was it that you actually found the most of yourself in this episode, or your ideas being used?
Well, it's not so much my ideas being used over anyone else's, because, you know, like you said, and has been mentioned before, it's like the process is so collaborative. Like, I mean, at the end of the day, I think and one of us gets our name on the script, but reading the script, it's like, oh, this is Angela, and this was Jeff, and, you know, this was Lindsay, and this was Ian, and this was somebody else, you know, and that it's such a, you know, Frankenstein's the wrong word, but it, and hodgepodge feels kind of cavalier and lackluster, but it's just such a confluence of ideas to make these stories come to life, that it's just these little baby pieces kind of all over the place that kind of come together to become the script. But the thing that I feel, having watched the episode, that feels the most like what I brought to the table for this script, was I had the best time writing Malia beating up Theo.
just that part because was so satisfying.
Yes, just because by that point, he's just the
worst.
You just wanted to beat him up so much.
Yeah.
Cody is he's the nicest person in the world. Yeah. But when they call action, he is the devil. You know, and he's like the devil with a smile, and just want to punch him in the face all the time. And so when we were breaking the story, and we kind of knew that Theo and Malia were going to kind of come together for things that we will be seeing later on, we knew that, like, this was going to be the first step in a little bit bigger story that's being told this season. And it was just kind of through breaking what that larger story was going to be and how it was going to start, we were like, oh, well, you know, Malia would probably just, you know, beat the shit out of him. And just because of everything he's done. And when I realized that that was going to be my episode, I was so happy that I was going to get to write Malia, you know, breaking his arm and just punching the shit out of him all the time. And, oh, it just made me so happy. And actually, I think in my draft, it was a little bit more brutal, just because I was just like, you know what? I know it's not going to be this, but I'm going to write what I can to make it as hard as possible for Theo.
Yeah.
And it got reined in just a little bit. But I think, you know, that was the most fun to write, some of the most fun to write. Obviously, Kira is my favorite character, so everything with her was just amazing and wonderful to write. But, you know, getting to write the words that, you know, Malia snaps Theo's head back with a punch and all that was just like writing it with a big old smile on my face.
Yeah, that sounds very satisfying. I think in my recap of the episode, like when I recapped what we talked about on the podcast, I was like, yeah, I wrote something like, Malia beats the hell out of Theo. We're not sure why, but we're really happy about it, or something like that. Like,
doesn't need to be a replay.
No. I think that everyone just wanted it to happen, and there it is. So, yeah.
Yeah, it was great to watch too. I can confirm that.
It only took 12 episodes for Theo to start getting some of his justice.
Now, as a huge fan of Kira, what was it like to tackle an episode like this? And did you feel a lot of pressure to kind of live up to her character, or were you just excited to dive right in?
There was no pressure, at least for me, just because I was so excited to be writing her episode. My first episode on the show was 508, Ouroboros, and that's the episode where she leaves, you know, and so that made me very sad writing that, because, you know, Kira's always been my favorite character, even from when she wasn't even a character. She was just this conceptual idea of this new character we wanted to bring on the show, and just immediately I was smitten with that character. And then, so, you know, when we were, you know, breaking 508 and then writing it, you know, and just being like, you know, everything is kind of coming to a head with her, you know, and that they had to leave to figure out, you know, to go somewhere else to figure out what's going on, because, you know, Kira's was becoming, you know, this liability almost, you know, and they just needed to get her under control and to figure out exactly what was going on with her. So we always knew. We knew when we were breaking 508, just when Kira would come back in 5B, and I was always keeping my eye on that episode, and thankfully Jeff just pointed at me and said, all right, 513, that's you, and we'd already been talking about that it was going to be a very Kira-heavy episode. So as the whole time we were breaking that episode, and then when I was writing my script, it was just so much fun to write all the stuff with her, and you know, her and her mother especially, just because I really love the dynamic between them, you know, especially because, you know, she's a child, you know, she's 16, 17, she's a teenager, and her mom's 900 years old, you know, so it's this great dynamic, because, you know, there's always, when a parent is trying to give advice to a child, you know, there's always this disconnect a little bit of, you know, like 20 or so years, you know, because of the ages of a parent and a child or something like that. But now we just have this even wider gap where it's almost, you know, nearly 1,000 years, you know, and just the way, I love the way Noshiko, played by Tamla Tomita, you know, the way she composes herself and the way she speaks and how she does everything she's thought everything through, you know, and she knows that what's happening right now is just a drop in the bucket, you know, that the emotions Kira is feeling, Noshiko has felt too many times, you know, but at the end of the day, like Noshiko tells her daughter, she's like, you really need to start thinking in terms of years, you know, that the time you have with people and the time that you have on this earth, just because, you know, kitsunes are basically immortal. Unless you kill one, who's to say how long they're going to live, you know? And I just love that dynamic because Kira's, you know, hot-headed is the wrong word, but she's in love and she loves her friends and she wants to fight and she never wants to back down and she always wants to be standing at her friend's side, you know, for every battle that comes their way. And I just love this dynamic between them. So getting to write those scenes and break them with everyone at the table and everyone's ideas coming together to figure out and then eventually hone what these scenes would be between this mother and daughter was just great fun, you know, and it was wonderful and amazing.
That's such an interesting factor to take into consideration, like Noshiko's age, because definitely we talked about like how, you know, it's not, you know, it's not Scott and Melissa, is it? Like, they're not very cuddly, this, you know, Ken is the dad, he's more warm. But Noshiko, like, sorry, she's incredibly, like, proud of Kira, and she's incredibly, you know, clearly loving and willing to, you know, do things and sacrifice things. But her approach is, you know, in general, it's quite, I don't know if cold is the word, because I don't think that there's a lack of emotion about here and there.
Yeah.
But there is a definitely kind of it's not, you know, they're not very demonstrative. She's very kind of, yeah, very clipped and very practical, even, you know, obviously she's doing this stuff to save Kira's life. And, you know, for her, she's like, oh, you know, Kira will be gone for, you know, in her perspective, you know, oh, Kira would be gone for a few years, and at her age, you know, that's nothing. But I didn't really even think about that age factor when I was kind of thinking about the dynamic between Kira and Noshiko, just more like the personality factor. But I suppose once you've been alive that long, kind of you have a different perspective on what matters and how much to freak out about stuff.
Right. No, absolutely. And that's really, to me, very interesting about Noshiko's character is her age, you know, and that she doesn't lose her cool, you know, and she doesn't lose her temper very quickly just because she realizes what's important and what isn't. And not to say the emotions and these things that Kira is going through aren't important. Noshiko knows that right now they are the most important thing in the world. It's just, when you add on another 500 years of Kira's life, she's going to have experienced so much more, you know, and again, you know, not to trivialize what she's going through in Beacon Hills and her time with, you know, the Teen Wolf cast and all of that, and these characters, you know, it's just Noshiko has been through so much more, and she understands, you know, what everything means and what it will mean to Kira later on. You know, and because she has, you know, the wisdom of time, you know, on her side, you know, and you're absolutely right when you say, you know, it's not like a coldness you get from Noshiko. It's just things are very matter of fact, you know, but that's such a great moment, though. But that's what gives you that great moment at the end when, you know, like through the episode, you know, Noshiko has said, I will leave you with the Skinwalkers, even if it takes years for you to figure this out, because she she's thinking about Kira. She's not thinking about anyone else. She's like, we have to get you figured out. We have to understand what's going on with you because you've got to live forever, you know, and what's happening in Beacon Hills, while it's terrible, it'll pass. You know, this is whatever's going to happen is going to happen, you know, and that we're just going to live through it, you know, and but, you know, they can't live through it if Kira is, you know, if the fox spirit is wielding her in a way it shouldn't, you know. So but then, of course, all that, you know, leads to that great moment when, you know, the skinwalkers are coming for Kira and Noshiko just rips that sword right off her back and she's ready to go to town on those skinwalkers. And she tells Kira to get the fox.
Yeah, when it comes down to the wire, she was kind of like, actually, maybe not, if you know what I mean. Like, maybe I don't, maybe I'm not going to give in to this that easily.
Right, exactly. Yeah. And I think the great thing about that moment is that Noshiko loves her daughter more than anything in the world, you know, and that Noshiko has not hidden her emotions, but she keeps them in check. Just because, again, she knows that, you know, this too shall pass, you know. But then just like you said, when it comes down to the wire and you're in that moment, you know, there's, you know, she's, you know, you don't get between, you know, a mama fox and her little baby fox, you know, it's just not something you do, you know, if you do, you're going to pay the price for it. So yeah, but that was a great moment. And it's just, you just love Noshiko even more because, you know, it's. Everything she's doing is for Kira, but then at the end of the day, it's, you know, I can't leave her. So it was wonderful. It was so much fun to write and then to see it shot. So it was great.
So this entire kind of story, what made you want to tackle it, the Skinwalkers, like as a mythology? Because that's another new one, you know, and, you know, we don't know too much about what they would have actually you know, done to Kira had she stayed, either to be healed or to be kept there. Even, you know, why they were saying that, you know, if you fail a test, you know, you have to stay. I have some questions about, like, what that means. Was it, like, that was, you know, she would be too much of a menace to society? Like, you know, that they were protecting the world from her? Or was it, like, a payment? Like, you failed, so you have to pay the price? But just in general, like, the Skinwalker mythology is obviously a real mythology, a Native American mythology. We saw images of them in the fresco as a tease for coming up for Teen Wolf 5B. But when did this idea start coming into play and the connection with what they were asking of Kira?
Well, the idea of the Skinwalkers has been around for several seasons. You know, it's just like up until season 5, and then more specifically 5, or the end of 5, at the end of 5 is when we were figuring out, you know, exactly where Kira was going and what she was going to be up to. But the Skinwalkers themselves, that idea of these, you know, interesting Native American myths had always been around. And we, you know, it's like at the beginning of every season, we always talk about a lot of different ideas, you know, and that's what we're doing right now with the breaking of season 6 is just figuring out what ideas we want to tackle. But it's just every time we brought, you know, Skinwalkers to the table, it's just the story wasn't right yet. You know, it just didn't feel like they were falling into place correctly. And then when we knew Kira would need to leave Beacon Hills just for, you know, safety reasons and, you know, for the characters, we were trying to figure out, you know, it's like, well, where is she going to go? Who will help her? And of course, our initial ideas were, oh, well, she'll go to Japan. And we had all these wonderful and lofty ambitions for, you know, her mom and dad taking her to Japan. But we were like, well, you know what? Japan is really far away from Beacon Hills. And we're going to want to go get Kira. You know, we knew that we would be going to get Kira at some point. And we were like, well, we can't really spend that much time going to Japan to get her. So let's stay stateside. And then the Skinwalkers just popped up again, and we thought they would be these fun and interesting characters to tackle. And of course, you know, when we said that, so, you know, we all dove into research and quickly, you know, doing research is one of the best parts of working on the show is just because it gives me, you know, us an excuse to just be geeky and read about interesting things. But like one of the things we realized reading up on the Skinwalkers is that the Skinwalkers are bad guys. They're boogeymen. And that was interesting to us, you know, because, you know, just because you think someone is bad. Right. Just because a legend says something is bad. Well, that's probably not, that might not be the truth. you know, the same thing with Kitsune's, and that's why we have that great line from Noshiko where Kira's saying, you know, all the reading I've done about Skinwalkers are the bad guys, and Noshiko says, you know, they say the same thing about Kitsune's, you know, so it's a lot of fun taking a myth, you know, the way we do every season is taking all these wonderful myths and then shaping them to work in the world of Teen Wolf, you know, and then also taking ideas that you think someone's a bad guy and turning them good, you know, or taking a good guy and making them bad, you know, and just those ideas were just a lot of fun. And yeah, I mean, the moment we started talking about them and conceptualizing them, I mean, we just had a lot of fun figuring out what Kira was going to do with them and how they were going to help Kira. And of course, you know, it's like, well, there has to be like sword fights and spear fights and all that type of stuff, which was always fun and wonderful. So I think I answered your question. I hope I answered your question.
I think so.
Okay.
And, you know, the Skinwalkers do come from legend, obviously. And Jeff has said in another interview that it comes from Navajo legend.
Yep.
So, and we heard that there was also a consultant there for you guys to make sure that, you know, everything was correct and that things were kind of presented, I guess, the way they're supposed to be represented. What sort of advice did they give you?
I met with a woman named Pamela Peters, and I met her through the Writers Guild of America. Mm-hmm. They have a sort of a Native American liaison for writers who put us in touch with Pamela Peters, who I got to meet. And she was, in fact, very wonderful. The day we met, I had sent her, I think it was my first draft of the script and some conceptual designs for what we thought the Skinwalkers would look like. And we met at a Starbucks in Culver City, and we spent, God, I think it was, I remember, it was several hours just talking about the characters and what they represent in mythology and what we wanted them to represent. And, you know, and we went over the sketches that Jeff had done and that Barbara, our amazing costume designer, had done. And it was really, you know, we had a whole bunch of pictures of like real Native American, like on one side of we had this big piece of paper, and on one side was pictures of real Native Americans in their in Native American attire from different, you know, festivals or everyday life and celebrations, and the clothes they would wear to go to war. And then on the other side of the paper, we had our conceptual drawings, and it was really finding a balance of both to meet somewhere in the middle, you know, because, you know, and that's always the fun and challenging part of working with something that's real, is because you want to you know, honor and respect what came before you, but at the same time, you're telling this new story. So you want to bring your own ideas and content to the mix. And so it was really just, you know, taking all these pictures with her and Jeff and Barbara and finding this wonderful middle ground that ended up becoming the basis for what the Skinwalkers looked like. The paint they wear on their faces is modeled on real face paint from Navajo warriors and Navajo myths. It was a lot of fun, you know, just trying to, you know, it was like a big old puzzle and just putting all these pieces together that would end up being these three wonderful characters that we would get to meet on Teen Wolf. So it was a lot of fun.
They looked incredible, and I think that the look of those three characters is why part of the reason why we got so excited about them is because they look absolutely badass, and they are badass. I mean, they're kind of terrifying, but they're cool at the same time. And I hope, I don't know if anybody's going to do this, but I hope, like, I see some cosplayers at Comic-Con dressed as these ladies, because that would be so cool.
Oh no, that would be wonderful. And that was one of the best parts of creating those characters and finally seeing them realized when we were out there shooting, is they don't look anything like any other characters on Teen Wolf. Like, they were, you know, a brand new mythology, and so that means a brand new look, you know. And it was wonderful seeing them realized and standing out there on set with these giant Ritter fans blowing dust everywhere, and no, they were beautiful and badass and just amazing. And oh, it was just wonderful to see. I have plenty of pictures that are just great of them all out there working together, and it was wonderful.
That's kind of actually something to touch on, just jumping ahead a little bit there. is that, you know, often you don't necessarily get to interact with guest stars on location, you know, or go to, like, the shooting locations. So it sounds like you did actually get to go out to the desert, some of the shooting. Like, did you meet, like, these women, like, you know, or how was the performance directed? Like, did you have any part in actually being out in the desert, really?
We actually were out there the day they were shooting Kira and the Skinwalkers fighting at the top of the episode when she gets speared.
Yeah, the first.
And we were there for that. But sadly, we were in a real bind because we were breaking episode 515 on that episode. So we were out there in the writer's coach, and we spent the majority of the day in the air conditioning in the coach, you know, frantically writing 515. Just because we were a little bit behind schedule, as we often slash always are. And so we didn't get to see a lot, sadly. But when we did go out, it was, you know, Jen Lynch was directing, and she's, you know.
Yeah, I was going to say Jen Lynch directed this episode, which is quite a big deal. One of your more prolific directors on the show, like, to get on your episode.
Oh, I was so happy when they said Jen Lynch was going to be doing my episode. And I remember her first day in the office, I was in contact with some of the PAs, like Jeremy and Kyle and Felix and everybody up front. And I was just like, all right, when y'all see Jen Lynch arrive, you know, please text me because I want to come out and talk to her. And they, you know, say, oh, okay, she's here. And so I skipped basically up front and just told her that I was so happy she was directing my second episode. And she was like, oh my God. And she just gave me this big bear hug. And it was wonderful. And we just talked, and she had read my draft, and she was really happy. And it was great. And it was a lot of fun. And then just, she is just this wonderful fireball of energy. And when we would take a break from working in the writer's coach, we'd walk up to the Vasquez Rocks where they were shooting, and she's just out there, and she would talk to Kira and Noshikona, the Skinwalkers, and they would talk for a second and confer with our stunt coordinator and our stunt actors and our stunt players, and then she'd go back behind the camera and she'd call action, and they would watch this take of the fight, and then she'd call cut. And would just explode and be like, oh my God, that was the coolest thing I've ever seen in the world, you know? And she just runs up and hugs everyone. It was like, oh my God, that's so cool. We should do it again because it'll probably be even better the second time. And it's so awesome. And she just, everything that happens on set is amazing to her. And she loves everything and everyone. And it's just, it's great when that kind of energy comes onto set, you know? I mean, we have a lot of the same directors, you know, Russell and Tim, who have been directing with us for years and years and years, and they are just professionals and pros, and, you know, making, you know, when it comes to shooting an episode of Teen Wolf, it's practically down to a science, you know, and we just, you know, everybody puts their head down and, you know, we're having a good time, and we know what we're doing, and we're just doing it. And then, you know, and that's the great thing about having guest directors, is we get this new blood and new energy that comes in, and it just reminds us how much fun it is to actually make this show. And you know, it is always hard. It's never easy. And you want to quit, and you just don't want to do it anymore because it's so hard at times. But then it's just, it, you know, someone like Jen comes along and, you know, she walks through the art department and is just amazed at all the artwork for her sets and for, you know, sets for, you know, coming up for later episodes and for the costumes and for the actors and to work with the stunt people. And, you know, just being out on location is just amazing. And, you know, she just goes crazy with how much she loves everything. And it was just a lot of fun. I was really, really happy that she directed my episode. So, and she did such a wonderful job. Like, everything is wonderful and amazing and looks great. And, you know, just going from, like, these wonderful, you know, Jeep scenes with Scott and Styles, you know, where they're talking about these heavy things and things that are very emotional, to these wonderful, you know, fights between Kira and the Skinwalkers or Kira and the Oni later on and all that. And it was just so much fun. As everything is.
Yay. Karen, do you want to jump back to that other question?
Yeah, I got a little mixed up. Where are we now?
Well, I just jumped right ahead to, because Will mentioned actually going out to set, so I jumped ahead to that one, Will did actually talk about the look of the Skinwalkers, so I don't know if this question is still relevant, if you can see on the doc.
Okay, so I'll just go to the passing of the test, right?
Yeah, because I'm curious about, like, what the test was actually meant to teach.
Okay, all right. So the fox actually is the one that passed the test, but that means that Kira failed it. So what can you tease us about her journey going forward, given that information, and if we'll actually be able to see the skinwalkers again? Please say we'll actually see the skinwalkers again.
We might be seeing some skinwalkers down the line.
Yes.
Anything is possible.
Yes.
So, you know, we'll just see what happens.
Cool.
But, yes. So the fox spirit inside of Kira passed the test, and Kira didn't pass the test. And there's this line from, I believe, Dark Sky, the skinwalker, who says, "You wield the sword, but the fox wields you." And that's very important, because Kira and the fox spirit have a very symbiotic relationship. You know, Kira isn't the fox and the fox isn't Kira. They are two beings that live and cohabitate in her body.
Yeah.
And when she says that the fox wielded Kira, that's kind of not supposed to happen. Mm. You know, the fox, as we've seen over 5A, the fox, you know, like when Scott looks at Kira with his wolf vision, and all, the fox just is getting bigger and bigger, you know, and especially when the fox, you know, defeats the Oni, it just gets massive and just destroys the Oni. And it you know, the balance between Kira and the fox is becoming a little bit more lopsided towards the fox. And that's not good. It's always supposed to be an even balance, and with a little bit more so, Kira should be wielding the fox.
Mm.
You know, the fox is the power and Kira is the vessel for the power.
Yeah.
You know, so it's the power is beginning to take control, and that's not good, you know, and some very bad things could come of that. And that's the problem, is that Kira is not in full control. And that's, you know, like the fear that Scott had of losing control to the alpha monster, you know, that he was, you know, back in 3A when he was running up the steps and he saw the shadow of the alpha werewolf chasing him and all that. He was always worried with losing control of the monster inside of him and becoming Peter and becoming what Peter was in season one. And that's a little bit what Kira is going through, is that the power within her is taking over. It's becoming too powerful, and that's that can be very problematic going on further.
Yeah, because with Kira, you know, it does really seem, you know, we've already sort of discussed this before, that it's much like more like two beings. It's not like
exactly. She
isn't, you know, she's not a werewolf. It's not a part, I mean, it's part of her, but it's not a part of her. It's kind of like she's the host for this other spirit that, all, you know, as well. And, you know, she's not able to sort of keep on its little leash, basically. And
exactly.
And one thing we were talking about as well is, like, the fact that we barely ever see Nachiko, like, use her Kitsune powers. We see her fight and stuff, but I don't know if we've ever seen Nachiko really break out, like, her own, you know, fox and what that relationship is like there. And obviously it's a lot more balanced than Kira's.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
We had ideas. Oh my God, the ideas we had. okay, well, to talk about not seeing Nachiko.
If you remember, fox, yeah.
Yeah, right, using her fox. If you remember in 3B, she had 9 tails and she broke them all.
Yeah, that's right.
The tails are very important, you know, and Kira gets her first tail at the end of season 4. And with each tail that a Kitsune earns, that is experience and power. And the more tails you have, the more powerful you are. And Nachiko sacrificed a great amount of her power to keep the Nogitsune in check.
Yeah.
You know, and so she in 3B sacrificed a lot of herself and a lot of her power to defeat the Nogitsune. And that's why, you know, you see in season 4 that she got wounded.
Mm.
You know, and like you also see in season 4, Kira is wounded in a very similar way, and she didn't bounce back as fast, but she bounced back, you know, and she healed Nachiko because she sacrificed so much of her power. She doesn't have that much power anymore, you know, and her healing faculties are greatly diminished. You know, she obviously recovered from the berserker attack in the hospital, but it took time, you know, and that's where she is. She's still very skilled, and she will still continue, you know, living for a very long time because the fox spirit is still within her, but it's just greatly diminished. Mm. And going back, and we had, oh my God, we had so many ideas for when Kira and Noshiko would meet the skinwalkers. We had this one idea that the skinwalkers would have different animal spirits. So one was a wolf, one was a panther, and one was an eagle. And that's actually not accurate with the skinwalker mythology. So that's one of the reasons why we lost that. But also, it would have been very expensive visual effects-wise. But we had this idea that when Kira and Noshiko met the skinwalkers, that the skinwalkers' animal spirits would come out and coax the fox instead of a sword fight. Ooh. Instead of the sword fight at the beginning, it was these animal spirits kind of circling them and coaxing the fox out just to see what's there, you know, because, you know, they were testing her, you know, that very first sword fight Kira has with the skinwalkers was a test, a little mini test to see what they were dealing with.
Yeah.
And in original versions, it was much more explicit where their animal spirits were going to coax out the fox to see exactly what they were dealing with. And as this was happening, we had this idea that Noshiko is standing off in the background, and right beside her was just this little purple fox spirit just kind of sitting at her feet, you know, and it was very small and delicate to show how much power she had lost compared to how much power her daughter has.
Yeah.
You know, and oh my God, it was going to be so wonderful and beautiful and perfect and amazing. But then of course we did more research and spoke with Pamela, our consultant, and you know, that's not accurate with the mythology, so that had to come out sadly. And also it would have been very expensive, but my God, it was going to be amazing.
It was
amazing. We had a great time just figuring out how they would coax the fox to come out and all this, and it would have been amazing. But I am so completely happy with the sword fight that Kira has with the skinwalkers, because it's beautifully shot by Jen and Dave Daniels, our DP, and just perfectly done. So, you know, we didn't get that first idea that you want, and that's the way it is with breaking stories for television and just breaking stories in general. Is, you know, with your first ideas, you go to the moon and back, you know, and you just want to see everything that's perfect and amazing. But then time and money become factors, and you have to start reeling it in, and what you end up finding is always the better thing. Like, I don't think we've ever had an idea and then done something else for an episode and regretted it later, because it's always, when you get down to it at the end of the day, like that sword fight with Kira and the skinwalkers was much more emotional, because we're, you know, we keep cutting to Noshiko and she's watching her baby girl fight these, you know, very old and ancient creatures, you know, and she doesn't know what's going to happen. You know, she has no idea how this is going to play out. And that's what's most important at the end of the day is always that mother-daughter relationship, you know, and keeping that, you know, first and foremost in everyone's mind as it's going forward. And while having the animal, you know, the different animal spirits of skinwalkers would have been amazing and cool, it's not what it was about. You know, that's not the point of that scene.
Yeah.
And what we ended up with was just brilliant and beautiful, and I love it.
Cool. If I can ask about something from the skinwalkers' perspective, I don't know how much you're able to channel them, but put on your skinwalker dead wolf hat and see, basically for them, you know, what do they kind of, I don't know if it's something we'll find out more about, but what do they kind of, you know, do with their lives? Like, you know, like what are they, Kira and Shika have the conversation about whether they're, you know, evil, or, you know, and they said that about Kitsune too. You know, are they kind of a force for good? Are they kind of above that? Are they about balance? Like, why would they even bother help Kira? And why would she need to stay with them if she failed? Is it to protect the world because she's too dangerous? Or is it like a punishment? Like,
punishment isn't the right word. Really not a lot I can say at the moment.
Okay.
just because of what will be coming later.
Okay.
But I have amazing headcanon for certain things that we should definitely talk about at the end of the season.
Okay.
Because yes.
It's all this stuff that I have, all these ideas that for me, until we say otherwise, it's what I believe is going on.
Okay.
But but the Skinwalkers aren't good or evil. Mm. You know, they're very much like Kitsunes, where Kitsunes are a little bit more amoral. You know, a Kitsune won't do something because it's good or evil. It'll do something because it just wants to see what'll happen.
Mm.
You know, and the Skinwalkers are not exactly like that, but they exist beyond, for us at least, and for me, beyond good and evil, where it's just we're here for a purpose. And you might, you know, like Kitsune or like Akira believes that purpose is terrible, but from what her mom was saying, it doesn't actually sound that bad because it seems more like protection. You know, and they're beyond good and evil. You know, they're something else. And we should totally talk more about this after 520 is aired.
Yes, yes, please, because I just want to say kudos to you guys for making me care about the Skinwalkers so quickly. Like, they weren't even necessarily a focus of the episode because the episode was so well balanced between all of the characters. And yet the Skinwalkers just stuck out to me. And I'm like, I want to know who they were before they became Skinwalkers. I want to know why they became Skinwalkers. I want to know what they do, you know, just hanging out in the desert and stuff. And you know, who else has joined them in the past and right. all of this other stuff. And so, yeah, after 520, let's chat again and just talk about Skinwalkers. We'll do a whole episode about Skinwalkers.
No, I would love to do that because I got ideas that I think are pretty awesome and that we talked about in the room. But of course, you know, I mean, it was just too big for the story we're telling at the moment. But
yeah.
If we don't say that's not what's happening, then
it can still be what's
totally
happening.
What it exactly, exactly. That's what I believe it is. And until we say otherwise in the show, who's to say that's not what's going on? So,
fair enough.
So yeah, good stuff.
Karen, did you want?
I'm sorry. Real quick, one last thing. What you were saying about making you care about the Skinwalkers so quickly, that was definitely important to us because we definitely wanted the Skinwalkers to feel like the tip of an iceberg, you know, where we are just touching this other mythology that, you know, we're only giving you a glimpse of what else is in the world of Teen Wolf. And that's one of the things I love so much about our show is, you know, like talking about the Skinwalkers or the Dread Doctors and all that. It's just I love that. You know, every now and then online or something, I'll see a post or something. It's like, don't you remember when Teen Wolf was just a show about teenage werewolves? And I was like, yes, I do. But then it's just every season you just take one step further back and you realize that there's always more going on than just what you think is happening, you know. And I love that about our show is that, you know, each season is another step for Scott into a bigger world, you know, and for the characters as a whole. And that to me is always very interesting. And just meeting the Skinwalkers is just like, what the hell is going on with them? Who are they? Are there others? What are they doing out there? You know, it's just this wonderful little bit on the side that's like, oh, and look, if you were just to pan the camera to the left a little bit, you would see this whole other world, you know, and all that. And that's always very interesting to me. And I like to think we succeeded with the Skinwalkers on that level of presenting this greater world and greater mythology just beyond the edges of the frame.
That was kind of something we talked about as well that I was really interested in. You know, you mentioned, you know, originally we wanted her to go to Japan and, you know, like, why wouldn't she go to, like, the Kitsune gods to get fixed or something? But but I kind of liked the idea that, like, that this whole world of mythology, like, you know, sort of is familiar with each other and that, you know, it's the same kind of magic and the same kind of spirits, just, you know, that have developed in different ways in different countries, and that it is all interconnected, that it's not like, oh my god, I've never heard of that, you know, and all that kind of stuff, that, you know, that it's just grown in different ways in different places, but it all sort of comes from the same roots of the, you know, the way the supernatural has developed and how it can cross over with each other, basically.
Right. I love that. And I like when we introduced the Nawal in season 4, like I just love that idea of a South American jaguar shapeshifter, you know, and how that's kind of like, not to say that there's a one-to-one correlation, but it's almost like that's their version of a werewolf.
Yeah.
You know, in that part of the world, that's what the shapeshifters, that's kind of
what
shapeshifters
what
are. Some of them, at least. Right, exactly. And so that, you know, getting the same thing with, excuse me, that the skinwalkers are almost like the Native American version of a kitsune. You know, where they're these creatures that are not good, they're not evil, they're amoral, and they just live a very, very long time. And, you know, and I love the idea, like what you said, is that the mythologies are interconnected, you know, where it's Noshiko knows the skinwalkers. How? When did she meet them? I don't know, you know, but I mean, that's an interesting story in and of itself, I'm sure, you know, and just her knowing that they exist and what they do. You know, so that it's – I've never liked in stories where it seems like the mythologies of certain parts of the world don't come into contact, where it's like it's – where they're just kind of black and white, you know, and where there's just not much of a mix. And I love that in our world, the mythologies are – they mix. They're, you know, all over the place, you know, that people know about other mythologies and things like that. And that's just very exciting because I feel like – one of the great things about our show is we are very inclusive, you know, like we don't have like racism and sexism and things like that doesn't in homophobia. Those types of things don't exist, you know, where it's just like the very first, like in the very first episode, of the pilot, like when Scott goes to, you know, he pulls up on his bike, you know, and he goes to school and it's just like, oh, look, all these kids, there's two guys holding hands and a boy and girl holding hands and everyone's just, they're themselves, you know, and no one has to hide. And I like to believe that exists, that carries over to the mythological world too, where the skinwalkers aren't, I mean, they're kind of separate from the world because of what I like to believe they do, but I mean, where it's not like people are bumping into these new mythological creatures all the time, where it's, you know, Noshiko's lived almost 1,000 years and she's probably run into a lot of supernatural creatures, you know, and it seems like it would be impossible not to, you know, and I love the idea that it's just everything touches and everything mixes and it's, yeah, it's just, that's just the way I like it.
So. I mean, one thing, Karen, do you remember when we kind of talked about the concept that there might sort of just be one supernatural strain of genetics, and it's not like, oh, you get bit by a werewolf, you become a werewolf. It's kind of like you get brought into the supernatural and you come whatever, you become whatever it is in that it's in your genes to be. Because, for example, Scott becomes a standard werewolf because that's what, you know, he is. But then other people who have bitten by werewolves haven't necessarily become a werewolf. You know, like we've got, you know, we don't know what the difference is between a werewolf and like a were-coyote. Like, you know, whether that is a, you know, genetic thing or a made thing or whatever. Lydia, you know, her banshee powers kick into gear once she gets attacked by the, supernatural, by Peter. You know, Jackson became a Kanema, and Kate, when she, you know, got turned by Derek, didn't become a standard werewolf. And I kind of wonder if there's just like, you know, this, you know, say a gene, you know, like Weapon X or something, like, you know, a weird gene that basically once everyone, it's the same X-Men, exactly the same, in that every mutant is different. The mutant gene is the same, but it presents, every person has the potential to be a different sort of mutant, if you know what I mean. And I kind of wonder if this supernatural world has something similar, because, you know, it's like, okay, you get exposed to the thing, the supernatural thing, the gene, the bite, whatever it is, and it presents itself in different ways in different people, but it's all the same thing, if you know what I mean. And I don't know, that was just a theory we were talking about a while ago, just in the idea that, you know, people who have had, you know, say a standard werewolf bite don't necessarily become a standard werewolf, and how, you know, whether it is all interconnected or not. So I don't know if that's something the show will ever explore, but if you want to get down into the gritty science of it, but I am really interested in that. So, yeah.
Yeah, that's exactly how I like to think about it. I mean, we've talked about that in the room, and we have, you know, we all have very different ideas, but for me, at least, that's what you just said is exactly how I like to think about it. Just because, you know, again, you know, Jackson was bitten by a werewolf but became a Kanema.
Yeah.
You know, and Kate was turned and became a Nawal. And I like to think, I think I'm going to butcher this phrase or whatever it is, but it's something like, you are whatever it is you have inside you to be.
Yeah.
You know, it's that type of idea that it's we all have it in us. It's just whether or not we're exposed to it.
Yeah.
You
it's
know?
Like every, it is. Yeah. Like every person yeah, has a different potential, locked up supernatural aspect, and then they get the supernatural chemical in them by whatever it is, the bite or genetics or whatever, and then that's what they become. But it's all kind of like, you know, it's like whether you have red hair or blonde hair or blue eyes or whatever, it's just it presents itself differently in different people rather than them sort of all being different species and unrelated and stuff. So I don't know.
Right.
X-Men, the mutant gene is the best example I can think of. So
yes,
so,
that's a great correlation or a great example is the mutant gene. We all have it. It's just whether or not it comes out in us and whether or not we're exposed to the supernatural. And that's I love that.
Yeah. I don't know if we've got a bit off track. Karen, where were we? You wanted to talk about Kira and Scott.
Yeah, switching gears just a little bit. Obviously, the end of the episode brings Scott and Kira back together, and their relationship is a little bit complicated because of everything that's going on with her and with what's happening in Beacon Hills, but they're still a pretty solid couple, and Posey has said in some interviews that you're going to see a different side of them this season, that, you know, we've kind of explored the cute and the adorable and the awkward, but they're going to continue to grow as a couple. So can you talk about any of that?
Let me see. They will continue to grow, and that is going to be a lot of fun to see. And exploring the relationship between Scott and Kira has always been a lot of fun to talk about in the room, you know, just because Scott and Allison, they were very hot and heavy, you know, because that first season was very much Romeo and Juliet, you know, and this illicit love affair. And with, you know, Scott and Kira, we definitely wanted to go in a different direction, you know, and Kira is very different from Allison. And of course, that creates a new relationship, you know, for Scott and Kira to be in. It's just the way they are together. And having her, you know, her leaving was a great blow to Scott. And now having her back is wonderful, and we're just going to have to see what that means for them and to see exactly what's going to happen moving forward. That's really all I can say about it at the moment, just because I don't want to inadvertently give something away, because I am every word I say I'm double checking in my head to make sure that's something I can say. So but no, we've got good stuff coming with them, and it's going to be good. It's going to be good.
And then, of course, you know, Kira's been out of the loop for a little bit. Not super long, but she did leave town and everything. How is she going to react when she finds out everything that's been happening? And her coming back into the pack as Scott tries to rebuild it, you know, what can you tell us about how that's going to go? Is it going to be, like, super awkward trying to fit back in, or is she going to just, you know, be who she always was and sort of slide back into place?
Well, she's definitely going to be who she always was. But of course, she's coming back with the knowledge that she's still, for lack of a better word, broken.
Got the problem, you know, that she went away to fix.
She's, she went away to fix a problem, but she couldn't find the solution to that problem. So she is coming back the same person, but there's still this, there's still a shadow over them, you know, cast by the fox spirit. And that's definitely going to be something to contend with as things go on. You know, Scott's by her side and she's by Scott's side, but things could get rough moving forward, just because, again, like you said, he's got to rebuild the pack. Styles is back, and now Kira's back. But I mean, they're just the tip of the iceberg for the pack. And it's, you know, if, you know, season 5A was the destruction of the pack, and season, you know, 5B is very much the rebuilding of the pack. And we spend a good amount of time rebuilding the pack, because, you know, we can't just rush through it all in one episode, because so much went down in the first half of the season. So there's, you know, as each new member hopefully comes back into the fold, I mean, there's going to be drama coming with each of them, you know, and, you know, there's good stuff coming later, and I can't wait for y'all to see it. So,
yay. Okay, very, very quickly, I guess my last question about Kira was her vision quest, the fight with the Oni, Is there anything you can say about what that was meant to mean? Like, was it actually real? But, you know, because it seemed like it was kind of affecting her. Was it kind of like a mental challenge? Like, you know, her own fighting her own demons? Or is this like something that you can't talk about?
It was very real. And conceptualizing that, that what the test would be, we went through so many variations. Like, I remember we pitched ideas of her like climbing a giant cliff face towards two of the skinwalkers at the top, but then at the bottom of the cliff face, one of the skinwalkers firing arrows at her, and so she's trying to dodge those. She has, you know, her goal is to get to the top of the cliff, while at the same time the fox spirit is coming out and just wants to attack the skinwalker firing arrows at her, you know. And we had all these different ideas of what this test was going to be. And again, time and money is always your worst enemy. And it just forced us to think about, what is Kira scared of? You know, like, what would be her fear? And we hit upon it, and I don't want to say too much about it at the moment, but the Oni are very much a fear that Kira has. You know, because if you look back at season 3B, the Oni were there to fix a problem, you know. So if Kira is scared of the Oni, it must be because she believes she's a problem, you know. And that was a lot of fun. And the test, I really don't want to – there's really not much I can say about it at the moment. But definitely stuff we can talk about at a later time. But conceptualizing that fight and how every strike of her sword was really hurting herself, when we finally hit upon that, we really liked it. And then, of course, writing it was much worse in my draft, you know, because I'm very much a fan of making it as hard as possible on the characters that I love. And I do love Kira, but you know, it was fun but difficult to write at the same time, just because it's you never want to hurt, you know, the characters you love. You never want to see them get hurt either. But this is very much a journey season for Kira. You know, season 5 is very much about, you know, while it's not at the forefront, it is very much about her and having to deal with these big profound issues of what it actually means to be a kitsune and what exactly goes along with that. And that's really all I can say at the moment.
Okay. Well, we could go into plenty of questions about different aspects of the episodes besides Kira, because we had a lot there. We had obviously Theo and his pack. We had the big moments between Scott and Styles as well. But the title, Codominance, is this something that you came up with, or Jeff? And what is the actual significance of this? Because I'm pretty sure it's a bit more important than the science lesson.
Well, the science lesson is very much, you know, a key towards it a little bit, because you're talking about, you know, traits of two different beings being in a third, you know, like the parents and their child. The title definitely came from Jeff. The title's very, you know, more often than not come from Jeff. And a lot of that has to deal with, you know, with what Kira's going through, is who is the dominant force in her, you know, and who, you know, who has the upper hand, you know, again, she's a vessel for this spirit, but they're supposed to be partners, you know, it's supposed to be a symbiotic relationship, but right now they're not really partners, you know. It definitely feels like the fox spirit is in control, and we're just gonna have to wait and see what happens with that.
I was gonna ask Damnatio Memoriae and the Demon Tailor, which we've been researching the real legends of. How long have you guys sort of been sitting on that idea, and also, you know, what exactly is the Damnatio Memoriae kind of being written trying to achieve there? Like, they said that it was going to, you know, try and make the, you know, the beast remember who it was. Do they mean to remember who it was as a teenager, or remember who it was in its past life of the Demon Tailor, or what's going on with there? And just how did you guys discover those legends?
Well, I'm going to attribute this, I think I'm correct, but if I'm not, and any of the Teen Wolf writers are listening, please call in and say that I'm wrong. I want to say that writer Bassan Masood found the term damnatio memoriae and kind of brought that to us. And the moment she told us what it was, we were all like, that is amazing. And we just we knew that was going to be important. And we started figuring out what that meant for the long run of the characters in this entire season. And, you know, the beast especially and all that. That's really all I can say about it at the moment.
It just feels a bit too neat. Like, not like a bit too much like it was there waiting for you, basically. Because, like, you know, looking into Damnatio Memoriae and then discovering that it happened to this, you know, real serial killer in France who had a nickname that was the Werewolf of Chalon. And you're like, when we have a French werewolf too, like, you know, like how it's sitting there, like coming across something like that and just being like, oh my God, like this was, you know, we have to use this. Like it's been sitting here waiting for us the whole time.
No, it was very much like that because we knew at the very beginning of the season, one of the very first things we typically talk about is after trying to figure out kind of like the status quos of all of our beloved characters is who are the bad guys and what do they want? And, you know, when we were figuring out the Dread Doctors, we knew what they wanted. We knew what their end game was. And we just, you know, of course, we're going to have to figure out, you know, the roadmap as we went along. But we knew all these big signposts that we were going to get to. And then when, again, I believe it was Bassan, gave us Damnatio Memoriae, a lot of other signposts just fell right into place. And we were like, that is perfect. And it very much, like you said, felt like it was waiting for us to just discover it, you know, because we looked up Damnatio Memoriae and all these examples of what happened. And then when we found, you know, the Werewolf of Chalon and all that, we were like, this is perfect. And this is amazing. And how have we not done this already? You know, it was a great find, and it really informed a lot of 5A, but then a serious amount of 5B, and, you know, specifically certain episodes coming up down the line.
Karen, was there anything specific about this episode that wasn't Kira that you wanted to kind of try and get a bit of a handle on at all? I just had a little bit about Scott and Styles, which if we read Brooks' little message, we can talk about then. But for you, was there anything else? Like, what else did we talk about in the episode? We talked about a little bit about Meredith and why Deucalion is blind again and all that kind of stuff that's, you know, straight up going to be a spoiler. But
I mean, not anything that I know Will can divulge or that I'd want him to divulge because, you know, I want to be surprised. So,
of course, I can tell you why Deucalion's blind again.
Oh yeah,
he just loved all those sunglasses so much. he's like, I've had sunglasses for like the last 10 years. What am I gonna do with all of them? All right, fine, I'm just gonna blind myself again. So, I mean, that's really it. That's really all it is. I mean, it's not really much of a spoiler.
So, oh my God.
He had all those canes with, you know, the blades at the end.
Well,
was he just gonna throw all that out? I don't think so.
Yeah.
That is literally what it is.
That's a lie, I'm assuming.
I don't believe it.
But yeah, because obviously the last time we saw him, he got healed, but we didn't know if it was like temporary or if it was like Pinocchio. The more bad he does, the more his eyesight leaves again. Like, you know, like he got a second chance and he fucked it up, so now he has to be blind again or what. But yeah, I'm curious about that.
We'll see.
But, okay, so the biggest part of this episode for most people, besides from the Kira aspect, was, you know, Scott and Styles going on their road trip, which is like, you know, we love a road trip, you know, we love a road trip. And, you know, Brooke was very excited. She said to tell you hi and thanks for the Skittles
hi,
road
Brooke.
Trip. You know, she said, you made my year with that, so.
No, she is very welcome, and we knew when we knew we'd be bringing Kira back, we knew that episode would be her dealing with her problem, but also Scott and Styles going to get her. When we started figuring that out in 5A, that was kind of like for a long time, all we had for that episode was Kira centric and Scott and Styles on a road trip. And we just love that idea. And, yeah, that was a lot of fun, just because, you know, 5A was very much about the things we don't say, you know, and they even say it in the episode. It's like, if we had just kept talking, if we had talked for 5 more minutes,
yeah,
this wouldn't have happened, you know, and
yeah,
and
I think,
and that was something. Oh, go ahead.
I think that that's really important. Like, something that I wanted to ask as sort of my final thing is, what was the most, you know, important thing for you guys that you wanted to say or to have them say in this final understanding of the situation? Because over the course of, you know, the past however long, we've had, you know, Scott freaking out about Styles killing someone, you know, like Styles says, you know, he's broken your one big rule and that was it, you know, and you're out. And then we've had Scott kind of forgiving him and being like, no, I want to be back with you, Styles, and not even caring what actually happened. Like, he thought Styles really did hit him over the head with the wrench, and he was still like, yeah, Styles, I still love you. And then here we have the situation of him actually learning what happened, and Scott was like, oh my God, that's like totally no big deal. That's totally fine. Why didn't we know this sooner? And there were definitely some people kind of complaining about, oh, that's so out of character. Scott would never do that. You know, he would never think like that, you know, back when he sort of, they had the rift and then, oh, there's no communication. But to us, it always kind of seemed like it was like this missed communication very much on purpose. And this episode where they clarified, you know, actually what happened, you know, the fact that they did actually say, you know, if we'd kept talking, we would have figured this out. And that kind of thing happens in real life. Like, people don't really understand, like, each other, and they don't understand that they're not understanding each other. It's not even a fundamental, oh, you don't get me, I don't get you. It's that they don't realize that they're not on the same page about what's going on, and that they don't realize that there's a misunderstanding. And I think that's very truthful, but I was surprised that they sort of actually stated that so head on. So, yeah, what basically, I don't know, for you guys, what was it like, you know, what did you need to actually put them back together?
The big thing for us was, you know, as we were breaking 5A, it's like, we were, why is Scott reacting this way? Mm. You know, like, this is sort of out of character, but what is the reasoning behind this? What is it? And it was when we landed on, like, what he talks about in the episode, that he always knew at some point someone would kill another person. That, that it was just bound to happen.
He was prepared for that.
Yeah. And he was prepared for it. He just always wanted it to be him. Mm. He didn't, because like what he says, that he's always throwing them into these situations. And but you know, of course, that's not true. Like, one thing as I was watching the episode, and even as I was writing it, and I'm sure there were reasons we didn't do it, but I wanted Styles to say, like, you're not throwing us into this. Like, we do this with you, you know? And, but it's, Scott is very much the keeper of his friends, but he always wanted to be the person. If someone was going to die, he wanted it to be him who did it. He wanted to be the person who took the life, because he wanted to bear that burden. He never wanted any one of his friends to go through that, you know? And I think when he finally realized, you know, when he learned from Theo that Styles had killed Donovan, for me at least, I don't think Scott was really listening to what Theo was saying beyond that point, where it was just in his head, it finally happened and it wasn't me. Now my best friend has this, and I don't know what to do about it. Like, I don't know how to talk about this yet, you know? And I love that, you know, that Scott just wanted it to be him if it had to happen. But sadly, it happened to someone else, and he wasn't prepared for that. I think in his heart of hearts, he was prepared to be the person in the pack who killed somebody.
Mm.
But then it was such a gut punch for him that it wasn't, that it didn't happen, you know, that it was someone else, and it had to happen to his greatest friend, you know, that it had to be Styles, you know, and it just, I think, tore his world up, you know, and was just a serious, you know, gut punch for him, and that it just kind of tainted his actions moving forward, you know, at least that's the way I think about it myself, and the way I wrote it, you know, when I was writing those scenes and things like that, and when we were breaking those scenes together, you know, and yeah, so yeah.
Cool. Karen, I'm going to ask one more question head on that, you know, is hopefully going to either be confirmed or a complete and utter bust. Is Scott covering up the fact that his powers aren't working properly, or are we misreading that?
You can read it however you want. No, he is holding back a little bit, because you have that moment in 5.11 when his shirt's you're seeing the blood through his shirt, and he says, you know, they're in the hospital and Styles has just kind of wailed on him a little bit, and Scott says, you know, your dad isn't the only person who got hurt, you know, and he's saying more, he's like, oh, he's like, look, I'm buddy hurt. I died.
Yeah.
You know, he's like, I died, you know, and Styles says, oh, you'll heal, you know, but I mean, Scott is kind of holding that back a little bit, and just because, again, he died, you know, and 5B is very much a rebuilding of the pack, but I mean, at the end of 5A, Scott lost some of himself, you know, and I don't mean just through the dying. I mean, through losing his pack and his friends, you know, and so a lot of, you know, so 5B is very much rebuilding the pack, but it's rebuilding Scott, you know, and everyone will hopefully come out of this better people, you know, and that's very much, that's part of it, yeah.
Cool. Karen, any final thoughts there? I went off book a bit there, but I just, I had a few questions who are not Kira related. So anything else that you want to try and tease out for the rest of the season?
Just one quick question, because I do want this to go up ahead of the next episode, and I'd like to do a little article on how awesome Kira is and some of the things that we talked about. But for next week's episode, is there anything that you can tease us? Doesn't even have to be like spoilers. It could just be like character moments or something, just something to look forward to in next week's episode.
Oh boy. Next week. Hold on. Let me pull out the script, because it is all one giant episode in my head.
I can imagine.
It is really hard to sometimes keep things straight. So let me pull up the script and see what's going on in this episode. I even remember what this episode is called. Oh, my God.
I always have to look it up if that makes you feel any better.
Yeah. Okay. This is Angela's episode, and she's a fantastic writer, much better writer than I am. And what's going on in this episode? Scrolling through the script. Some stuff going on. Oh my God. Oh, that's the script.
Okay. Wow, that's
ominous. I forgot about all of that. Okay, let me see. What can I?
I'm suddenly terrified.
Yeah, be terrified. We got shit's going down in this next episode.
Oh my God.
Oh man, let me. Oh man, what am I gonna say?
It can be like a total cryptic. There's a great scene with this and this that you'll never see coming.
Or like, I really like Kira's boots in this next episode.
What is Kira up to in this episode? Oh man. Hold on. There's a ton going on in this episode. Let's see, thing and that part right there. Oh, that's right. That's terrible.
Wow.
Yeah, a lot going on. A lot going on. You know what? I can't really talk about Kira. I can't talk about much. But this next episode is going to be intense. Theo does terrible things, as he does in every episode. And he's just terrible. He's just the worst character possible. What else? Yeah, it's going to be a tough episode. But it's going to be good. And this is a great lead-in to episodes 15 and 16, which are a great two-parter. And 14 has a great central story with God, can I even say that?
Yes.
With Malia.
Yeah.
It's this very Malia-centric episode, and there's just a lot of good stuff coming. And yeah, that's all I can really say at the moment.
Okay. That's good. That's something to look forward to. I mean, I don't know if I look forward to it because it sounds horrible and painful, but yay.
There will be horror and there will be pain.
Sounds like an episode of Teen Wolf.
It sounds exactly like an episode of Teen Wolf, so you shouldn't be surprised. But it's very good. A lot of really good drama. Yeah, this is a good episode because we are, now that Kira's back, we are just really putting the pedal to the metal with getting the band back together as fast as we can because we got, you know, the pack's got stuff to do.
We got shit to do.
Yeah, we got shit to do. And and I just want to say one last thing is, like, I rewatched the episode this morning just to have it fresh in my mind, and I lost my shit twice. The first time was when Theo and what's her name, Tracy, are in the high school and they're talking to the Dread Doctors, but then in the background, out of focus, in slow motion, the Beast comes around the corner. Mm-hmm. And it's just seeing Tracy and Theo backing up, and all you hear is the giant footsteps coming closer and closer. Oh my, I loved it. It was shot so perfectly. And the fact that it was out of focus, you know, that the Beast is in the background, you know, and even out of focus in the background, the Beast is still terrifying. And I love the bit when, I can't remember which Skinwalker it is, but she throws her spear and punctures the car tire. And then immediately pulled out her hand and another spear comes up out of the ground.
Mm-hmm. What did you call her? Dark Sky?
Yeah.
The one with, like, the full white face. Because I remember thinking, like, first of all, totally badass, but also it reminded me of Harry Potter when they, like, bring up their
when they get the rooms.
And yes, I was like, that is so cool.
Right, and that wasn't in the script. At least I don't remember that being in the script, and I don't know if I ever heard about that, but I saw it, and I cheered when that happened. I was like, that is the coolest thing, is that she loses her weapon and just holds out her hand, and another one comes to her.
Yes.
And I was just like, oh, I want more of these characters. They're so cool.
Yes, but, please. I will tell you, I screamed when Scott barrel rolled out of the Jeep, like actually screamed.
Yes, no, we were conceptualizing what that would all look like, and how, you know, we were like, okay, well, you know, they're racing in the Jeep, but how does Scott actually get there? And we pitched that to Jeff and totally didn't think it was going to land. You know, we thought it was going to be like, no, that's going to be really hard and take a lot of time. But we were like, all right, Jeff, you know, the Jeep comes barreling in and the door flies open and Scott, you know, barrel rolls out and comes into a full roar. And Jeff was like, that is pretty fucking awesome. And that's exactly what we're doing. And it was just so much fun.
I don't know why everyone keeps making such a big deal over the barrel roll. It's literally how you're meant to exit a moving vehicle if you have to throw yourself out of a car. It's true. It's not like, you know, because there's been some unnecessary backflips in this show before. But this one was like literally, if you have to go out of a car like that is moving, you don't just jump and, like, you roll. That's what you do. So I don't know why everyone thinks this is so dramatic.
Natalie, it's just the fact that Scott was like, yes, I'm here, I'm helping my woman, and he just comes out of that car, and it looked sweet, and I bet, yeah, it was just awesome.
Cool.
No, it was so great, and you're exactly right. He's like, that's right, that's my girlfriend. What are you going to do about it? Nothing. You know, no, it was... it was great, and you know, and of course, you know, and I love that he, you know, barrel rolls out and gives this great roar, and you're like, oh my God, Scott's about to kick some ass, and then Noshiko's like, no, I got this, you can get in the car.
Yes.
And he's like, yes, ma'am, okay. And he just jumps in the car, and she, like, slices that spear in half.
I liked
you know,
that. The spear slicing was my favorite. My other favorite was, we haven't even touched on, was actually Mason. And in his conversation with Corey before they did some gratuitous making out, but in just the statement of him saying, you know, like, you know, when Corey's kind of like, but don't you want to stay alive? And him saying, not if it means
standing with the bad guys.
I'm like,
no, absolutely.
Child, I'm just like, oh, this child is just so great. And I just, that was my favorite line in our quote section last week. So I just wanted to say that.
No, yeah. that's a great line. And I loved when y'all talked about in, was it 5:10? no, 5'11 or 5'12, but I don't remember exactly, but I love so much how much y'all I'm messing this up. I loved how much y'all loved when Liam ripped the page out of the book and Mason just his head explodes and has no idea what to do.
Pause. I love that they lingered on the pause. It was so funny.
Yes, they could have cut it at any point, but they just let it go. Yeah. And it was, I laughed so hard because I hadn't seen that. Yeah. I hadn't seen the dailies for that scene. And so I wasn't until the episode aired that I saw it. And I was just laughing so hard because he was just so shocked and crestfallen that his best friend would defile a book like that. Yeah. And oh, God, I loved it so much.
I love that character. He's so great. So
yeah, he's wonderful.
Yeah. Oh, I think that's it. Hope he's not the beast. Most people think he is. Except Karen. Karen's got a whole different theory about the beast, which you can listen to in our episode if you catch up. Karen has a massive theory about who the beast may be.
Oh, I want to hear it. What is it? Please tell me.
You may be getting shot down immediately, Karen. You realize that.
Maybe, but who's to say that he's telling the truth?
That's very true.
Mm-hmm. I think it's very Scott. True. And I have a lot of evidence to back that up.
Okay. All right.
We'll roll with that for now. sure. But yeah, it's interesting that they haven't even started to delve into that yet, like who it might be. And just, you know, I've had some thoughts about, you know, is it just the reincarnation or, you know, the resurrection of the monster, or is it a resurrection of, like, the human that also was the monster, like the Demon Taylor guy as well? Like, why were they even talking about that and all sorts? So interested to see all of that. But, yeah, that's for a future time, I suppose.
It is for a future time.
Yeah.
But, no, but that's very what you said about why aren't they talking about that yet. And that's as we were breaking, you know, these first episodes of this half of the season that, you know, we kept talking about that. And it always came back to the pack is what's important at this moment is Scott knows he can't do it on his own. And he knows that terrible things are happening and he has to stop it. But he has to have his friends, like he has to do it with his friends at his side. And he knows that the bad things are happening, but he knows that the only way he can combat this is with his friends at his side. And so that's the first and foremost thing on his mind.
Yeah. Good. Okay. Well, I suppose we can leave it there. You probably have a life to get back to and stuff. So we might as well leave that there. But yeah, Karen, anything else that you wanted to say before we go?
No, I think that was it.
Cool. All right. Well, that has been illuminating and fun and enthusiastic. It's nice to, you know, always nice to talk to you guys, you know, and you in particular, you know, with the amount of enthusiasm that you have. And, you know, because I think a lot of fans out there, there's been, you know, a bit of a funny dynamic with fans and creators over the past however many years, like not with Teen Wolf, just in general, about, you know, thinking about how invested fans are in characters and stories versus how invested creators are and whether they actually care as much as the fans do, if you know what I mean, like, you know, whether the fans and it's sort of nice to talk about it from the perspective of how much people actually do care about their characters themselves and stuff like that. So that's, you know, you're always a good example of that, I think, for people to realize that, you know, it's not like some money makers in a room thinking of how to play the fans. It's people who are just as invested in these stories as, you know, the fans are. So that's
I mean, we agonize over these characters in this show. Like, I mean, we don't do anything cavalierly, and we don't do anything, you know, without having thought it through. And I'm sure there are people who think otherwise, but it's just not true. And we are very invested in these characters. We love Scott and Kira and Malia and Liam and Brayden and every single character. You know, it's just we get the privilege to write their story, and that's what it is. It's a privilege, you know, and it's the greatest job in the world, and it's just an incredible amount of fun. And the real fun actually comes from getting to come on this podcast and talk to y'all about something that y'all love and that I got to help create, and it's something I love too, you know. So, I mean, the best part is doing this for the fans because I get to talk to you guys about it or get to go to a convention and talk to other fans about it, you know, and that's the best part is someone being so excited for the thing you're excited to work on, you know, so it's just the best.
And bridging that gap like that between fans and creators does not happen all that often. I mean, I know that there are like tons of creative people on social media and everything, but actually being able to sit down for an hour and a half with somebody who wrote an episode of, you know, one of our favorite television shows, I think is just, it's exciting for us. I would assume it's exciting for you guys to get, you know, immediate feedback from fans. And I think it's awesome to give fans an insight into how that process works, because before I started doing this, I had no idea. And I've learned so much from doing it. And I think overall, it just, it makes it so fun, you know, to be able to talk about it.
No, absolutely. It's just the best. You know, and I love it. So it's great. Oh,
cool. Have you ever cried watching the show or writing the show and talking about, like, you know, oh my God, this happens, and then like made yourself cry?
Oh yeah, I cry whenever I write an episode because it's just so good
that
I can't believe that I'm writing something so exceptional. No, that is complete bullshit. Please, no one take that. Every single sentence in a script is agonizing to write because I write it and then I'm like, what if this is terrible? What if this is just not good at all? And I turn it in and all the other writers finally realize that I'm a hack and can't do this job, you know? And no, it's terrible. No, I teared up quite a bit when Allison died. I didn't think I would, just because
you knew everything about it, like you'd broken
right,
it down.
Right, yeah, like
so
by
much.
The time, yeah, right, exactly. By the time it had happened, you know, it had been shot, you know, months prior, and we were thinking about the next, about season four at that point. Mm-hmm. But then when it happened, my eyes were stinging. I was very surprised at how much it affected me, you know, and especially, you know, when Scott tries to take her pain and she says it doesn't hurt and all that. And, I don't want to talk about it because I might cry.
Yeah.
But,
all right.
But
I was
no,
like, please stop.
That was a great moment. And that moment, but then really any time Melissa gives Scott advice, it's always the best. You know, whether it's, you know, when they're under the stairs and she tells him to be his own anchor, or at the end of 5A when she tells them that, you know, every leader suffers defeats, and even when a leader has nothing left to give, they always have hope. Mm. You know, they can always give their friends hope, and that was just amazing. You know, and then Melissa pulls it off, no matter, you know, just amazingly, because she's perfect and wonderful and beautiful and amazing and perfect. And you know, so yeah, no, it's just wonderful and great.
Cool. All right. Well, we'll let you go and get back to real work or life and stuff like that. But thank you so much for coming and talking to us about the episode. And yes, we're very excited for the rest of the season, and we'll talk more when it's all done, I suppose. And yeah, about what the hell's been going on. So, yeah.
It is my absolute pleasure, as always. And like I said before, I love the podcast, and just keep up the great work. And I love listening to the episodes, and it's always just so much fun.
Well, thank you very much. It's very weird, but thank you. All right. Well, we'll talk to you all next week, listeners, I suppose. We'll talk to you all after next week's episode aired, where apparently shit's going to go down, and hopefully you've enjoyed hearing a bit about this episode, Codominance, and all of that good stuff from Will. So thank you very much to him. So we'll all say bye, and then yeah, wrap up. So bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.